Thank you. I am a small man, so I speak standing, so I can see you more or less. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to take part in this very interesting conference. Now, at the end of the 19th century, Pope Leo XIII wrote, "The world has heard enough of the so-called rise of man. Let it hear something of the rise of God." When he made this statement, Leo XIII did not know that the world was far from...
You have to be a little bit closer.
Yes. So, yeah, I shall disappear from your view and I shall sit down. So that you can listen to me. Obviously. It works. Okay, when Leo XIII made the statement, he did not know that the world was far from having heard enough of the rights of man, and he could not imagine that the second half of the following century would have been called the age of human rights. However, he was insightful enough to recognize the inherent tension between rights of man and the rights of God, which is the topic of my intervention. Defining the terms I use from the very outset of my presentation will help avoiding misunderstandings. By rights of men, and of women, of course, I mean the rights that belong to every human being by the mere fact of being a person. By rights of God, I mean the rights that are claimed by an individual or a community out of the conviction that they correspond to a law revealed by God or included in a cosmic order that precedes every human being. My intervention moves from the observation that the conflicts between rights of God and the rights of men are on the rise. Religious practices are the first area in which these tensions emerge with increasing frequency. Circumcision is a good example of this strained relationship. Circumcision is a practice of fundamental importance both for Judaism and for Islam, and shared also by other religions. It is a manifestation of the right of parents to transmit their own religious faith to their children. At the same time, circumcision entails a permanent, also modest, harm of the physical integrity of the individual. And it is usually performed on a newborn boy, and therefore without his consent. Many international conventions define the right to physical integrity as a human right. Therefore, it does not come as a surprise that in recent years it has been discussed whether circumcision implies a violation of that human right. The second area of conflict concerns the legal status of women in many religious legal systems. Human rights conventions prohibit any discrimination based on sex, but frequently religious laws exclude women from access to priesthood or other leadership positions in the religious community. And this exclusion also implies that women cannot perform some roles or take up some jobs within the religious establishment. This is the subject of heated debates, and the marginalization of women is often condemned as a violation of their human rights. The third area where rights of God and rights of man have come into conflict concerns religious affiliation. Conventions on human rights always contain a provision that grants freedom of religion. Also, some of them do not explicitly provide for the right to change religion. The General Comment number 22 of the UN Human Rights Committee has made it clear that freedom of religion includes the right to replace one's current religion or belief with another. The legal systems of most religions do not recognize this right and forbid their faithful to change or abandon a religion, sometimes imposing harsh punishment upon those who attempt to do that. Many lawyers consider the limitation, prohibition, and criminalization of the right to convert to a new faith or abandon a religion a violation of the human right to freedom of religion. There are many more examples of tensions between rights of man and rights of God. However, these three conflict areas are sufficient to clarify the terms of the problem. On the one hand, there are some rights that are qualified as human rights in the most important international conventions and in many national constitutions. As such, they are to be respected always and everywhere. On the other hand, there are rights that are directly or indirectly attributed to the will of God. Their respect is regarded as a religious obligation to be upheld, even when it implies the violation of human rights. And the faithful of a religion cannot accept the mandatory nature of the rights of men when they are in contradiction with the rights of God. These are the terms of the conflict, and the fact that they sink their roots in non-negotiable beliefs, rights related to the very nature of man versus right dependent on the will of God, this fact makes this conflict particularly serious and complex. Up to now, an open clash has been averted. States and international organizations have avoided a concrete confrontation with the Church on these issues because the state is obliged to respect the ideal of religious freedom, not only for the individuals, but for the religious institutions as well. In most cases, the internal autonomy of religious organizations, which is part of the right to freedom of religion, has barred any states and international organizations' intervention to enforce the respect of human rights within the religious communities. Circumcision, women ordination to priesthood, apostasy have been mainly regarded as internal affairs of the religious community that do not entail a violation of human rights as long as these rules and practices are not enforced by the state. But how long will the state maintain an attitude of reserve towards the discrimination in the church is a delicate question. Reflecting on the causes of this conflict between rights of man and rights of God is the first step to understand the best strategy to handle it. This analysis can follow two lines, structural and historical. The first line aims at identifying the fundamental differences between these two categories of rights, discussing whether the rights of God have some intrinsic characteristics that can help to explain the tension with the rights of man. The most important difference between Rights of God and Rights of Man had already been underlined more than a century ago by Max Weber, who pointed to the fact that it is impossible to proceed to a full rationalization of religious rules. Just because their foundation is heteronymous and is attributed to an authority that is external and superior to human beings, in the legal systems of most religions, there is a core set of rules that cannot be explained in purely rational or ethical terms. The strength of this set of rules does not reside in their ethical or rational foundation, nor can it be explained by reference to tradition or customs only. These rules are obeyed simply because they are dictated by God, for some religions, or rooted in the cosmic order for others. The Jewish prohibition of eating meat and milk together may have been supported at its origins by reasons of practical nature, but today it is respected only because observant Jews consider it an expression of God's will, not because it has a rational basis or a response to an ethical imperative. From this perspective, the compelling strength of the Rights of God is based on their origin from a power that comes from outside and is accepted because of this origin. Here, there is a significant difference with the Rights of Man, whose legitimacy is based on their rational or ethical nature. This tension between Rights of Man and Rights of God should not be exaggerated. But a margin of diversity remains, as shown, for example, by the Roman Catholic Church prohibition of the ordination of women to priesthood. The human rights provisions that prohibit discrimination based on sex are not blind to reality. They allow differences in treatment between men and women, for example, in relation to the retirement age, when they can be justified, when these differences can be justified in rational or ethical terms. But the ban of the ordination of women to priesthood is not grounded on these reasons. It is explained with a direct reference to the will of God. That is why no human being, not even the Pope, can modify what is taught on this point by tradition, which is a part of divine revelation. This is the Orthodox view interpretation of the Roman Catholic position. The second structural difference between Rights of Man and Rights of God concerns their universality. Not only the former, but also the latter, based on the idea that all human beings are created by God or are part of the same cosmic design, have a universal scope. There is, however, a difference. The Rights of Man that are grounded on the identical human nature tend to provide the same legal status for all human beings. Instead, the Rights of God provide a different legal status according to the religion followed by each person. As a matter of fact, there is no law of God. There are as many laws as the religions that are practiced in the world. From this point of view, the Rights of Man are more inclusive and uniform than the Rights of God. They do not involve a legal distinction similar to the division between faithful and unfaithful that exists in the legal systems of all religions. A good example of this difference is provided by the regulation of interfaith marriages. The International Conventions on Human Rights recognize to everybody the right to marry and found a family regardless of race, nationality, religion, and so on. The fact that two spouses profess different religions is completely irrelevant. The legal systems of many religions, instead, exclude or limit the right of their faithful to marry a person who professes another religion or no religion, and frequently refer this prohibition to divine will. Finally, a third element gives a different configuration to the two categories of rights we are discussing. The rights of man, as codified after the Second World War, are basically individual rights. Although they may be exercised collectively, and also some international conventions are aimed at protecting collective rights, their core consist of the rights that pertain to individuals. The rights of God, however, concerns both individuals and communities, and sometimes their institutions too. If we look at the Roman Catholic canon law, the Church, as the legal organization of the faithful, has rights and powers conferred by God himself. These rights of the ecclesiastical institution can easily come into conflict with the human rights of individuals and sometimes can imply their limitation. These structural differences explain the existence of permanent tensions between rights of men and rights of God, but they do not explain why they have become more frequent and more serious now than in the past. My second line of investigation addresses this issue through a few historical considerations. The post-Second World War codifications of human rights pursued two goals. The first, openly declared, was to put an end to the repetition of the horrors of Nazism through the legal recognition that every human being holds inviolable rights by the mere fact of being a person. The second goal, unspoken, was to create an alternative to communism, the last great ideological and political project that still had a worldwide appeal after the defeat of fascism and Nazism. In the aftermath of the war, from which it had emerged victorious, the Soviet Union was able to propose a vision of society and a political project that crossed state borders and inspired transnational solidarity and patriotism. The Western countries, under the US leadership, understood that this challenge could not be faced only at national level, fighting communism within their own borders. The confrontation took place at a higher level and required to be addressed from an international perspective. The legal translation of the human rights discourse provided an effective strategy. The post-Second World War declarations and conventions on human rights offered a global vision that could parallel the communist one, and the human rights became the subject of a new supranational patriotism directed towards the defense of the free world. This latter, characterized by freedom of press, religion, association, and so on, was conceived as an alternative to the communist world, where these freedoms were conspicuously absent. The great religions, threatened by the Stalinist persecutions, cannot but look favorably to this political project that played an important role in drawing them in the field of the human rights supporters. Therefore, the post-Second World War decades marked a time of appeasement between the rights of man and the rights of God, in a general context in which political and social modernization was identified with the secularization of public life and the reduction of religion to the private sphere. Things started changing since the 80s and the 90s of the last century, when religions began to regain a prominent public and political role, a process that began with the Khomeini's revolution in Iran, the rise of liberation theology in Latin America, and the triumph of solidarity in Poland. On the one hand, the threat of atheistic communism was dissolving. On the other, religious faith proved increasingly capable to mobilize people and give meaning and direction to their lives, contradicting the prediction that identified the modern world's future with increasing secularization and privatization of religion. The subordination of the rights of God to the right of man that was implicit in the secularization project weakened, and religions felt strong enough to reassert the distinctiveness of their worldview compared to that embedded in the human right discourse. The question, are human rights a religion and the United Nations their church, raised in 2014 during the hearings of the Holy See representatives at the UN Committee Against Torture, gives voice to this uneasy relationship and at the same time is a good example of the uncomfortable questions that religions feel now able to put to the most radical human rights advocates. The growing tension between rights of man and rights of God are explained by this historical process. As it is just at its beginning, it is urgent to explore all the strategies of conflict composition that can avoid that the revanche de Dieu becomes the defeat of human rights. Accepting that the tensions between rights of man and rights of God are unavoidable is the first step for their effective governance. These tensions reflect two different visions of the human beings, the one focusing on their autonomy, the other on their dependence by God or by a law that precedes men and women. According to place and time, the confrontation between rights of man and rights of God can involve different subject matters and can have a different intensity. But it is hard to think that these tensions can disappear once and for all. The fact that these tensions are unavoidable does not mean that they are insurmountable and cannot be controlled, managed, and even put to good use to build a society that is able to respect and promote cohesion and diversity at the same time. To achieve this goal, different roads have been followed. Some have rightly pointed out that neither the rights of man nor the rights of God are unchangeable. On the contrary, both are subject to a dynamic process of interpretation that grants their continuous development. Others have emphasized that within the perimeter marked by each set of rights, there is a variety of positions that belies the assumption that the rights of man and rights of God are monolithic constructions. These findings suggest that the conflict between these rights can be effectively managed by searching each time the balance point between them through a careful application of the principle of proportionality and the use of reasonable accommodation. Things become much more complicated when the focus shifts from the pragmatic management of conflicts between rights of man and rights of God to the conceptual systematization of their relations. Beginning with the rights of man, different strategies have been proposed. Two of the most popular consist in the dissociation between human rights content, which is universal, and the human rights language, which is particular, and in the distinction between values, universal, and rights, particular. But both strategies present important weak points. Another line of research offers better chances. It is based on the observation that the human rights regime is the jus gentium of our times, the common law of nations, which a variety of Hebrew, Greek, Roman, Christian, and Enlightenment movements have historically nurtured in the West, and which today needs the constant nurture of multiple communities in the West and well beyond. This formulation provides a dynamic notion of human rights, detached from any reference to an immutable natural law, and located at the meeting point between the respect of some universal principles and their particular and contingent translations in the laws of states and other political communities. An example will serve more than many words to explain what I mean. The example concerns the right to religious freedom, but the same argument applies to other human rights. Imagine, and we are not far from reality, that some followers of the religion are compelled to choose between abandoning their faith or being killed, converting or leaving their country, educating their children in a particular religion or being deprived of them. The overwhelming majority of human beings, independently from their cultural background, political views, or religious convictions, sense that there is something terribly wrong in being faced with these alternatives. This is, in my opinion, the proof that the right to freedom of religion has a universal, that is a transcultural core. This last statement, which concerns an issue debated for centuries, requires some further clarification. The sense of injustice I am referring to does not grow in the abstract, but is born from the concrete experiences that human beings make in the particular context in which they live. It is through these particular experiences that the perception of what is right and what is wrong develops, and is then projected on a universal level. This implies that the experience of the particular precedes that of the universal, and to some extent colors it, giving it specific features and characteristics. For this reason, our universal categories are inevitably soaked with specific and particular elements and components. This is why the same universal principle, for example, all human beings are entitled to enjoy freedom of religion, the same universal principle can be formulated in many different ways. This is especially true in the field of law, where the same universal right is naturally articulated in different ways depending on the cultural categories that are specific to each human community. Thinking that a right can have only one normative translation is the result of a profoundly anti-pluralistic legal culture. The identity of the right does not require the identity of its formulation, but allows a variety of normative propositions that reflect different cultural traditions. Of course, the danger that different normative translations end up invalidating the respect of the right itself should not be overlooked. But this is a risk which must be assessed case by case, accepting the possibility that the same right can have different normative expressions in a different cultural context. Again, one example can be helpful. In some countries, freedom of religion is guaranteed to all citizens by ensuring absolute equality of the civil and political rights, regardless of the religion they profess. In other countries, which adopt a personal law system, the same objective is pursued by allowing citizens to enjoy different civil and political rights according to the religion they profess. These two systems reflect the cultural and legal tradition in which the relationship between freedom and equality is differently conceived and structured. But both are acceptable if certain basic conditions are met. The same right finds expression and applications in different historical and cultural contexts, and within certain limits can acquire characteristics that are different and even contradictory with those that it assumes in other places. Avoiding the absolutization not of human rights, but of their legal formulation, seems a promising way to reduce the imperialism of human rights, which is criticized by many observers. This line of thought is helpful because it provides a dynamic view of human rights and diffuses the tensions between them and the rights of God. But it does not tell us anything about the latter, the rights of God, and implicitly suggests that the entire burden of settling the conflict between the rights of man and rights of God falls on the former. For this reason, it is necessary to integrate the previous reflections with some considerations on the rights of God, moving from the fact that they originate in a divine will or an immutable cosmic law, but are understood by human beings through the limited capacity of their intellect. If the rights of God are immutable, their understanding by men can change. Jewish law offers numerous examples of the transformation of divine law rules. Polygamy, permitted in biblical times and now banned, and repudiation, profoundly transformed to better grant women's rights, are the two best known cases. The absolute immutability of divine law is a myth that serves to fuel religious fundamentalism. Without denying the divine origin of a rule, we can deepen its understanding through its interpretation and find the most appropriate formulation for the historical needs of a specific community. In conclusion, I think that the dialectic with the different cultures and religions is what makes the development of human rights possible. In this perspective, the famous Maritain statement that the agreement on human rights can be achieved on conditions that we do not ask what is their foundation takes on a different meaning from the skeptical one that is usually attributed to this sentence. There can be no agreement on the foundation of human rights because this agreement is the unstable meeting point of the dialectic between different cultural and religious foundations and the dynamic point of balance between different interpretation and implementation of human rights. As long as these foundation and interpretation are not incompatible, their diversity has to be regarded as an asset and not as an impoverishment of human rights.
Thank you.